believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The Two-Way Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show, Two-Way Radio. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. Do a little bit of housekeeping right now. First of all, if you'd like to participate today, the call-in number is 800-313-9443. Wanted to let everybody know that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, that's the same group that really screwed up and showed how ineffective they were during the Hurricane Katrina event of a couple years back. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has been doing their very best to put their hands on old closed military bases. And what they're doing with those, what's going on, well, a film has been made. It is called Camp FEMA, and it is directed by a fellow by the name of William Lewis, and it features the likes of RBN's own John Stadtmiller, as well as Alex Jones, who appears in it. And you can actually get yourself a copy of this by going to republicbroadcasting.org and going to the online store. From there, you can get a copy of the new video, Camp FEMA, again, directed by William Lewis, and it features John Stadtmiller of RBN as well as Alex Jones, several other people. You can actually go online and take a look at that and read it. As well, if you would like to spread the good word of Republic Broadcasting, you can do so by getting some business cards. They are generic in nature, as in they don't have a name or a title, but they feature Republic Broadcasting. You could then take these things and hand them out to people within your circle of life, within your area of influence, people you know, people you meet on the street, people you have likewise sorts of conversations with, and hand them a card. Give them an opportunity to tune in and listen to all the great programming right here on RBN. Now, for 100 business cards, and including shipping as well, you also get a free bumper sticker. It's $8. It's straight up $8. For $8, you get the 100 cards. They get shipped to you, and you get an RBN bumper sticker with it. I've seen the cards. They're very good-looking cards, very high-quality cards. You can get those by calling the RBN office number. And now, Republic Broadcasting is in Round Rock, Texas, just a little bit north of Austin. That phone number is 800-724-2719. Again, that's 800-724-2719. And you can call that number Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Central Time. If you'd like to just mail in to order those, here's the address. You can send it to RBN at 2251 Double Creek Boulevard, Suite 302. Again, that's 2251 Double Creek Boulevard, three separate words, number 302. Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Again, Round Rock, Texas, two words. Well, Round Rock is two words. Texas comes next. 78664. And again, you can just send in $8. Let them know your name and address to send those cards off to. You get the bumper sticker. Everything's included. There's more show coming for you after the break, so stay tuned. It's definitely going to be some good information you're going to want to hear all about the Second Amendment and your rights coming up after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Rule 1, assume it's loaded. Rule 2, Don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Rule 3. Listen to the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. 1-800-313-9443.
All right, so I got to sit and tell you guys about something that's going on with me personally, my own life. That and we'll get into actually, I have a number of things to talk about when it comes to Chicago today and all of their horrendous anti-gun laws. But a little something that went down yesterday, a little over a year ago, about 14 months ago or so, I got a hold of the company that I pay my mortgage to. You know, times are getting tougher. Everybody's looking to refinance, renegotiate, whatever it is with their home. So I'm trying to do that. And the servicer is telling me, nah, there's nothing you can do. Okay, well, you're the servicer, right? Yeah, who actually has my loan? Well, the loan's been securitized, which at the time I didn't know what that meant. What it means is that my loan was sold off to a trust or an investment pool that had hundreds or even thousands of investors involved. And they said, so, no, I said, no. You guys, by law, you have to tell me who the hell has this loan, because I have the right, by law, to go and talk with them directly. So I need the name, the phone number. I need to know who I can go to. I got absolutely nowhere. So I told him, I said, you know, here's the deal. I am not going to pay my mortgage until I find out, because right now what I'm paying, I find to be unfair the way that you're handling it. You had a lot of leeway with some things. You don't even have the loan personally. You're just servicing it, and you're servicing it at your own discretion. So I'm not going to pay it. You guys will eventually start a foreclosure action, at what time I'll be able to bring it to court and force you to tell me. Well, it looks like I told them a little bit too much, because what they did was they did go into foreclosure action. They found a trustee that I have not found that's actually authorized to do business in Nevada. And that trustee was actually out of Southern California. They never sent me anything. I was never served with a thing. I never got anything through certified mail, through certified anything, nothing through regular mail, absolutely nothing. Then on July 6th, I found out that on June 29th, my house had been sold at a foreclosure sale. And the new company that bought it at foreclosure was trying to determine if the house was occupied. All of this was news to me. So, of course, now I'm really behind the eight ball. I'm like, uh-oh. I wanted them to force into a foreclosure action so I could find out who the actual lien holder was, whoever held the title, the deed, however you want to put it, so that I could then renegotiate, start from scratch. Plus, I'd save myself a few months' worth of mortgage payments, which is always nice. So that's the process I did. Well, having told them what my intents were, evidently they found somebody and they agreed not to tell me a word. Because once a loan's been securitized, I found out later, oftentimes they cannot produce anybody dealing with the loan because it is not within the Securities and Exchange Commission's rules of being able to do this. If they lost a house here or there, nobody found out, they could do a foreclosure, nobody looked into it, fine. They'd get their money. And the servicer would actually get paid for the home when the loan had already been satisfied. So I find out about all this. And I don't actually get real live proof of any of this until around August 3rd. Like, keep in mind, the house was sold quietly without anything in the papers, nothing ever being, not a scrap of paper being sent to me. On June 29th is when it got sold. I find out that it's Fannie Mae who bought the mortgage. And they bought the mortgage for roughly $160,000 over the current value of the house. The house went down in value quite a bit. And then they bought it for actually more than I bought it for. And $160,000 more than current market value. So, of course, they end up getting an attorney. It's not a U.S. attorney. It's a private attorney. And this attorney files a motion to have me booted the hell out of the house. I'm like, okay, finally, something's going to court. So I deal with a guy in Florida who is a paralegal who specializes in this sort of thing. And he's helped me out immensely on top of a couple of attorneys that are personal friends of mine. Actually, they're both non-practicing attorneys out of California, and California's allegedly the most difficult bar exam in the country to pass. So these are pretty sharp people, and really sharp because they don't practice. They're actually both in business, and they happen to have legal degrees, not so much to practice law, but to really know what's going on. One of them, however, was a prosecutor and spent a lot of time in court. So these two folks, or I'm sorry, these three folks are really helping me out with the pro se aspect of this. I had a court date yesterday. I was in here. Usually I sit here in shorts and a t-shirt. And today it's a long sleeve t-shirt because it's a little bit warm. Yesterday I'm in here in a suit, the best suit that I own. And I'm in here in a suit doing the radio show. I leave here. The show's over. 1 hour after the show's over is court. I'm sitting there for 45 minutes until the bailiff comes up and he says, I researched the opposing counsel. I know what the guy looks like. I know a lot about what's going on. I've done a lot of research. The guy's not in the courtroom. So the bailiff comes up while the judge is hearing a case. I think it's a small claims case. And he says, what are you doing here? So I showed him my paperwork. He says, hold on a sec. Goes and checks with the court clerk. Comes back and says, you know what? This was vacated. So you need to go out, leave the courtroom, go down the hall, go see a lady named Holly at the court office. So I go in there. I talk with this lady. Very pleasantly. I've dealt with her a couple of times, like when I was filing papers. Absolute gem. This lady is absolutely wonderful. So she says, yeah, it was vacated. I said, well, explain to me how this got vacated. She goes, well, really what happened was the opposing counsel called sometime last week, Thursday or Friday. I overheard a phone conversation they were having with another person in the office. And they said that they wanted it taken off the calendar so that they could deal with you directly on some of these issues. Because when I filed my response to these guys wanting to boot me out of my house, what I filed was, look, the original servicer violated all of these laws. Then they got a hold of a trustee who violated all of these laws. Well, the repercussion of that is that the new company that got it can't legally hold it. And on top of that, they're actually kind of a pseudo branch of the federal government. They wouldn't want to be interested in participating in this, what looks like a conspiratorial fraud. So on top of that, I'd like to move the court to void the foreclosure sale, which is, you know, within this particular Nevada law. It's all part of the same law that the trustee violated every provision of. But there's a certain amount of time involved in that. It's 90 days. Unless you have these circumstances, then it's 120 days. Well, 120 days comes up on about October 25th. So I have a certain amount of time. So opposing counsel looked at this, and they said, look, we want to deal with this guy on our own. If they really did, they would have got a hold of me before yesterday when I'm sitting in court for 45 minutes, not knowing that I'm no longer on the schedule. They didn't. So I think what they're doing is they either looked at the case and said, this guy's got some legitimate gripes here, and you know, let's deal with him, see if we can help this guy out. Maybe we'll let him negotiate with us, and you know, we'll be the new loan company. Or they looked at it and said, you know what, if we drag this out beyond, the 3.5 weeks into October, well, then the ticking time on this particular provision for voiding the sale goes away. And I think the latter. I think that's probably what's going on. So yesterday I went home and I typed up some more papers. I filed those. I've got some more to file today to really try to move this thing along and get this thing done, or at least get the judge to agree to say, okay, we realize that this time is here, but because of extenuating circumstances, I'm going to make the order, which a judge can do, and say, all right, I am going to hold this off. So I am the type of person, you've probably realized if you've listened to the show long enough, if you say you're going to do something, we have an agreement, all I expect is for you to just handle your end of it. Handle your end of the bargain. If you're not going to, tell me, let me know that you're not able to fill your end of the bargain. You're not able to do what you're going to do. Or something's come up to prevent you from that. If you know going in that you're not going to be able to do it, or it's a shot in the dark that you will, don't make the agreement with me. I don't have a problem with somebody saying, you know what, I'm not able to do that. What I have a problem with is when somebody says, you know what, that I will agree to this. This is what I will do. And then they just simply don't. I would much rather you never say that you're going to do it. Then I'm not let down. I don't put something into someone else's hands and then nothing gets done. You know the old saying, if you want something done right, you do it yourself. One of the reasons I'm going pro se is, yeah, I've got some really good people helping to advise me on some things. So I'm trying to push this thing along, see what's going on. And I got to tell you, if opposing counsel says, if they say, well, yeah, we want to get a hold of this guy and you know, see if we can work with him. Well, it's been, you know, towards a week, and I've heard absolutely nothing. Nothing. So, where I originally, when I felt so far behind the eight ball, I now feel as though I may actually be pushing these guys up against the ropes. I may be in the process of kind of a comeback victory in this deal when it comes to actually getting some things done, to where I'm a little bit more in the driver's seat, which obviously most people would prefer to be in that position. And we'll see. We'll see what goes on with this. I can't really get into too much more because of what's going on, but I just want to give you a heads up. Just, you know, there's one of the fighting sort of things that it looks like big business, even a small portion when it comes to pseudo branch of the government, trying to hose me over and standing up on my own with a little help from some friends and pushing all of this garbage back down their throats to get done what is right. So that's what I'm looking to do. All right. All of that to the side. I am lining up some guest hosts for next week. Just so you know, I will give you a little heads up when we come back. Who's going to be in next week? Not necessarily what day, but some of the people that have agreed to fill in so far. And also some things going on in Chicago. So stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, live, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
I am going to let you know some of the people that have so far agreed to actually sit in for me next week. And I sent out some feelers to some very specific people amongst the RBN family. One is Ernie Hancock. Ernie has agreed to do a show for me, sit in for me next week. Darren Weeks, one of the weekend hosts, has agreed to sit in for me for a day next week. John Moore, I'm really looking forward to having John Moore. John, of all of the hosts on RBN that deal with things such as Second Amendment, guns, self-defense, things such as that, John Moore is immensely qualified. I'm really looking forward to the opportunity having him sit in. Now he's involved in preparing for a case as an expert witness. pardon me. So he has tentatively agreed to sit in on a specific day, provided that nothing else gets in the way. I'm looking forward to that. I also have a feeler out there for Ralph Winterrude, and I've had many suggestions from you, the listening audience, to get Ed Winchester in here. And Ed, I'm about to dime his ass out right now because Ed and I, on a pretty regular basis, we share messages back and forth during the show. He'll send them during a segment. I'll respond during a break. Not every day, but now and again. Of course, we were just doing that. And I told him, I said, you know, I've had some emails from some of the listeners asking if you would be able to sit in, at least for a day. And he's coming up with every lame ass, say, oh, you know, I'll be out in the field. He's the boss. If he actually wants to get something done, he can get it done. And anyhow, so he's like, yeah, right, sure they are. I'm like, dude, I will forward you copies of the emails. Actually, when they've come in, I've told him, I've gotten on again. And it's just I've had a few over the last week, I think three or four, that said, you know, what about Ed? Seems like a lot of people began to identify with Ed and kind of get him figured out because we spent a whole week together doing shows in August. I mean, it was the second or third week of August. And it was great. So I think Ed's just, you know, kind of shying away and, no, I don't know. Oh, I don't know. Wuss. That's for you, Ed, you wuss. You opposable thumb bastard. Okay, so here we go. We're going to talk a little bit about Chicago. Now, Chicago gun advocates are predicting there's going to be a drop in crime if their handgun ban and incredible ban on a lot of other guns is lifted. Now, Supreme Court's decision last Wednesday to hear a challenge to Chicago's strictest in the nation handgun ban laws mean that of the other holsters ready to fall in on the ban, advocates on both sides of the issue seem to agree that something is going to go down. Something major is going to happen with this decision, most likely that Chicago's going to lose. A year from now, there's not going to be a Chicago handgun ban, said Alan Gura, the attorney representing the gun owners who are fighting the ban. Now, this is the same guy that argued the Heller case in front of Supreme Court in 2008, so a year and a half back. The High Court's five-member conservative majority last year threw out D.C.'s ban in D.C. versus Heller, but stopped short of invalidating the rest of the country's handgun bans because the case dealt with federal bans, not local ones. Actually, that's I'm reading this tidbits out of this story as I add in my own comments here. And in fact, it was a local ban in D.C., but because it's a federal property, it's a federal town, really, that it didn't go so far as to say states, well, or cities for that matter. But gun control advocates and even the city of Chicago officials have been bracing for the High Court's firmer embrace of the Second Amendment, which includes a right to bear arms. It's going to be very difficult for Chicago not to have to make the adjustment that D.C. had to make, according to Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign. The Brady Campaign to Take Away All Your Guns Because We're Jackasses Coalition, I believe is the name of the organization. At a news conference in Chicago this last Wednesday, Gura predicted the crime rate will drop in Chicago if handguns are legalized again because, he said, would-be burglars would not opt to break into homes for fear owners would be armed. Here's a quote, "I want to be able to protect myself in my own home. That is a right we have that has been moved away from us, and we should have it back," said Otis McDonald, 76 years old, a plaintiff in the case against the city's ban, and a retired janitor. He says the neighborhood of Morgan Park has gotten rougher in recent years. He continues, "I don't have any intention of going out there and shooting up anybody. The people who want to control me, these are the people I want to protect myself from." I wonder if he's talking about bad guys in the neighborhood or the government officials that don't want them to be armed. Huh. "I want to protect myself from the people who want to control me," is what he says. Interesting. Even though she was not harmed, Colleen Dawson said she wished she had a handgun when some men tried to break into her Northwest Side home last year. She's 51, and she said the court's action should be a message to Mayor Daley and other gun control advocates to begin looking at a handgun as a tool given to us as a birthright by the Constitution to defend ourselves. Couldn't agree more. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go into in the next couple of segments here, the next segment, next couple of stories, about some shootings and self-defense related things, crimes that are going on in Chicago. And my interpretation of what would go down with citizens being able to protect themselves with handguns. More after the break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
With Bill Carnes, 1-800-313-9443.
All right, I'm severely goading Ed Winchester into sitting in for a day next week. We'll see if it works. I have my ways. Chicago teen was shot in the neck on the far south side of town and is expected to recover. A teenage girl who was shot in the neck and critically injured remains hospitalized, unable to talk to police, but is expected to make a full recovery after the attack Saturday night in the far south side's, let's see, Adelage Gardens community? Altgeld Gardens community, I guess would be the pronunciation. The 17-year-old girl was shot about 8:15 p.m. in the, 13,000 block of South Prairie Avenue, according to police news affair officer Ronald Gaines. The girl was taken in critical condition to Advocate Christ Medical Center in Oak Lawn with a gunshot wound to the neck. Early Tuesday, detectives said the young woman is still hospitalized, where she remains incubated and unable to talk, but she's expected to make a full recovery. Detectives were looking for witnesses who can provide further information about the shootings. An arrest has not been made, and the area detectives are investigating. Now, here's the thing. It should be really simple to find out who shot this girl. Really simple. Because in another story, it came out it was a handgun caliber, meaning that somebody used a handgun to shoot this girl. Well, it's very, very, very simple. All you have to do is all of the police who worked anywhere near that area at the time this girl got shot is to check their supply of ammunition. Whoever's missing even a single round of ammunition from when they left to when they came back, well, there's your shooter. I mean, how simple is that? Why is this so simple? Because handguns are banned in the city of Chicago. Where this girl got shot, you're not allowed to even own a handgun. You can't do it. So therefore, only the cops have handguns. And since only the cops have handguns, if you know how much ammunition they've got when they leave the station, when they come back, if they're missing even a single round, you should be able to match that round up with the one that shot this girl in the neck, and bam, right there. You've got the person who shot the girl. Because handguns are otherwise illegal. Which means nobody else is going to have a gun. Right? It's that simple. It is that simple. Find the cop that's missing a round, and that cop is a bad cop. They fired the round and shot this girl in the neck. Period. End of story. I solved it from Nevada. I solved it 1,500 miles away. In just under 2 or 3 minutes. That's it. It's that easy. Because if handguns in Chicago were banned, nobody has them, right? You know? Where else would this girl get shot? Okay, two Chicago juveniles held in the backyard shooting. A juvenile boy was charged and another one remains in custody after the gang-related shooting of two 18-year-old men Sunday night in the back of the Yards neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. Deering District police officers, who were already patrolling the area at 9:20 p.m., heard the shots in the 5,000 block of South Justice Street, according to police. Two 18-year-old men were wounded in the shooting, and both were taken in serious condition to John H. Stroger Jr. Hospital of Cook County, suffering from gunshot wounds to their legs or buttocks area. Officers who saw the two suspects gave chase on foot. They must have been chasing more cops. They must have been chasing off-duty cops or playing close cops. The short chase ended when the capture of two male juveniles and recover of a weapon nearby. Wait, what? Two male juveniles? Under the age of... They weren't cops? No. I better read the rest of the story. Let's see what happens. According to police, as of 4:45 a.m., a juvenile boy who is 14 or 15 has been charged with aggravated battery, while the other one remained in custody and has not been charged yet. Wentworth area detectives are investigating. How do you have a 14 or 15-year-old cop? I don't get... Okay, wait a minute. First story we had was a 17-year-old girl that got shot in the neck with a handgun round. Well, since handguns are illegal in Chicago, it had to have been a cop, because they're the only ones authorized to have a gun. And then you've got two kids that shot a couple. It must have been some undercover, special, like, young teenage police kids that were trying to apprehend these 18-year-olds when things went awry, and they must use the gun in their attempt to apprehend these 18-year-olds. I mean, how else could it work? Because handguns in Chicago are illegal. You can't have them. Huh. You know, I'm starting to see a trend here. I wonder. Nah, you know what? Hold on. Let me go on. Let me read another one. The cops say that a slain Chicago Lincoln Square bar owner wasn't robbed. The owner of a corner tavern in Chicago's Lincoln Square neighborhood, who died after being severely beaten, still had $2,000 in his pocket when police found him, but his keys to the bar were missing. Officers found Robert Gonzalez, 69, lying in a driveway behind his bar of the O'Logan's Bar on Montrose Avenue at about 4:45 a.m. Sunday after the burglary alarm, and the business was tripped. Gonzalez appeared to have suffered severe lacerations to his head and died Sunday evening at Advocate Illinois' Masonic Medical Center. Well, they've got really, really long, drawn-out names for their hospital. Let's see. It has to be just someone with some type of pent-up anger, said Al Jean Schulter, who lives near the bar. Schulter said investigators told him they are looking at several individuals and they do not live in Lincoln Square. He declined to elaborate or say if police have questions questioned those specific individuals. Detectives don't know what sort of weapon was used in the attack or the motive. Huh. It sounds like that this guy, Robert Gonzalez, could have defended himself if he had a gun. But he wasn't able to because handguns in Chicago are illegal. So let's try to start wrapping this up here. We have a 17-year-old girl that got shot in the neck. She's expected to make a full recovery, thank God. We've got a couple of 18-year-old guys who got shot in the legs and the ass by some younger juvenile teens with handguns. And then you've got a guy who's 69 years old that was beaten to death, that had he had a handgun, could have shot whoever it was who was attacking him and saved his own life. Okay, so here we go. If you follow the law in Chicago, you don't carry a handgun. If you don't follow the law in Chicago, anybody's a potential victim. So there's a 17-year-old girl that got shot in the neck by somebody who had a handgun that wasn't supposed to have a handgun. Of course, all that thing about it must be cops is completely facetious. I hope everyone realized that. Then you've got like 14 and 15-year-olds shooting 18-year-olds. Obviously, they're not supposed to have handguns, but they do. The handgun ban went into effect in 1982, which tells us that the youngsters with the guns, now, if you were born in 82, that's the oldest you could, would have had to have been at least, bare minimum, by federal standards, 18 years old in 1982 to still be able to have a gun. All right. So that would make you, let's see, if you're 18 and 82, that would make you, what, around 56 years old? If you still were able to have some sort of grandfathered gun in the house, if it were, you know, maybe disassembled and locked up and put away and, you know, padlocked and security and, you know, high-focus laser beam protected, possibly. Now, I don't know exactly how far, I don't know if you had to get rid of the gun. But let's say you even could grandfather, you have to be 56. So these kids, obviously, that wasn't it. So they have guns illegally. Where did they get those guns? Through illegal means. Probably through the black market. Probably through somebody stealing them at some point in time, and they end up being on the street. So the law-abiding are unarmed, but the ones who could give a damn about the law, don't really care either way, they're armed. The one guy who should have been armed in this whole deal, Robert Gonzalez, lost his life. And the politicians who took away his right to have a handgun have blood on their hands. And he's not the only one. I would imagine that there's got to be thousands of people have just been murdered in Chicago that if they had a handgun on them, they would have been able to save their own lives. Of the 511 murders that happened in Chicago last year, 402 happened outdoors, and the vast majority involved one gang member shooting another gang member, according to police statistics. So now what we do is we have criminal enterprise accounting for the vast majority of these murders. Quite honestly, and this is just my callous nature, if gangbangers want to off gangbangers, have at it. Have at it. Lock them up in a big old stadium that's got concrete walls and a steel roof. Arm them all, and let's see who the winner is. If you are a pathetic, worthless, wasted piece of human dung, garbage, that just wants to be a filthy, worthless street urchin and just live a life of crime and be a pathetic, non-productive member of society. In fact, you're anti-productive. And you just want to go out there and you guys start killing each other off? That's fine. Just don't get any innocent people in the crossfire. Don't get any of the good people in the crossfire. Eliminate yourselves. That's Darwinism, you friggin' idiots. That is stupid people, stupid, worthless people, killing stupid, worthless people. It works out in the end. Unfortunately, you end up taking out innocent people in the process. So if 511 murders, 402 happened outdoors, the vast majority of those, let's say 320. That still leaves roughly 200 other murders in Chicago. All right? Now, of those, let's say that maybe 100 were crimes of passion. That leaves about, and I'm just, of course, I don't have all the statistics. I'm just kind of trying to use a little rational deduction here. Maybe another 100 were out there. So, from 1982 through 2009, right, we're talking a period of, through 2008, right, 2008. We're talking a period of 26 years. Now, if it were 100, let's say it was only 50 that were preventable homicides, 50, all right, 50 victims otherwise were decent human beings, law-abiding human beings that would be legally allowed to carry a gun. Let's say 50 in 26 years. That's 1,300 people in 26 years that the politicians would have blood on their hands over that died because they weren't able to protect themselves. Now, on the opposite end, had they been able to protect themselves, 1,300 dead criminals would be out there, potentially, if they all died. If they all got shot and they all died. Potentially 1,300 criminals would no longer be on the streets. Now, what would you rather have? 1,300 good guys still roaming the streets of Chicago, or 1,300 bad guys, murderers, roaming the streets of Chicago? The politicians have blood on their hands. That's it. That's what they've got. How could you see this any other way? The only way I see it, they have blood on their hands. In this case, going in front of the Supreme Court now, I can only hope that the actual statistics can be brought up. Not just to show, okay, look, we're going to argue this constitutionally. That's really what the Supreme Court is there. But if they could show, look, not following the Constitution has had deadly effects. Numbers show that anywhere between this number and this number of people who have been killed in Chicago, murdered in Chicago, since the gun ban went in 1982, if they were armed, their deaths could have potentially been prevented. Now, we've got all these politicians with blood on their hands because they subjected these people to their death. They subjected them to the will of the criminal. If you're subjected to something, that makes you a subject, not a citizen, a subject. You're not a citizen of Chicago. You're a subject of Chicago because you cannot protect yourself by their laws. My ass. Seriously, guys, my ass. You can't protect yourself somewhere? You know what? Don't go there. I've been to Chicago one time. I actually enjoyed the city. I was there for about a week. I was there for a convention back in, I think it was 1989, summer of 89. It's been a long time, 20 years. And I enjoyed it. It was in June, little muggy out, but it was during the air and water show. It was a nice time. Spent all of my time downtown. I stayed in Chicago Center and, you know, went to the John Hancock, went to the Sears Tower, ate some Chicago pizza, hung out with the dude who worked in the industry. He was from Texas. Just had a good time. You know, it was a good time. I was there with my dad. We were there at this show together. It was fun. Did not get to go to Wrigley Field. As a matter of fact, my ex-wife was just there. She was just watching the Diamondbacks play the Cubs at Wrigley Field. Had a fantastic time. But I got to tell you, if they're going to legislate you away from being able to protect yourself, they don't care about how much blood is on their hands. The politicians there will bathe in it and rejoice. I think that's what Bloomberg wants to do, is to literally be in his own bloodbath with the blood provided by innocent civilians, citizens who were turned into subjects. Stay tuned, more after the break.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443. Uncle Sam taught him to shoot
maybe a little too well. Finger on the trigger, loaded. And welcome back from the break, guys. We have a caller, John from Indiana on line one. John, welcome to 2A Radio.
Hello.
How are you?
Anyway, yesterday you mentioned the amendment process to the Constitution, and of course, notice that it's complicated and it takes a long period of time. The most efficient way to amend the Constitution is by the use, or rather the abuse, of the treaty power. And therefore, the Bill of Rights have to be read in conjunction with the Human Rights Convention of the United Nations. The Human Rights Convention is not a list of rights, it's a list of privileges. And to say that the Human Rights Convention has compromised the Bill of Rights is understatement. I think now you can understand how we got into this this police state. Daddy got the Senate to ratify the Human Rights Convention, and his son arranged the necessary emergency to withdraw the privileges and put us in the present mess that we're in.
You're right, and I believe the only way to change that is to actually change the Constitution to where
that would not work.
You don't know if it would work because you're not listening to me.
Moment.
You're not listening to me, John.
Remember,
it's my show. Okay.
Yeah, pardon me.
If the Constitution were changed to show where the treaties were not just ratified by the Congress the way they are, then we wouldn't have to deal with the treaties. But of course,
the difficulty there is that the treaty law is supreme to the Constitution, and therefore any change in the formal Constitution is irrelevant. That's why I think that we have to. I don't think people realize how ugly our Constitution really is, and I think that secession is the proper way to get out of the mess.
John,
we simply have to secede from the federal government. I think there's an action in Texas in that direction.
The Lone Star State, and you better believe they'd be the one to do it. John, that's the Lone Star State. They would certainly be the one to do it. John, we're running up on the end of the show. I appreciate you calling. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for your time. I'm not saying by any means any change of the Constitution would ever be easy. Is it possible to actually take an amendment and pass it to where we no longer have to deal with these treaties? Yes, it's possible. Is it feasible? Not on a cold day in hell. So could you say the Constitution itself can override an amendment? No, obviously the amendment has more authority over the Constitution because the Constitution's been amended. Now, that's simple high school government class sort of stuff right there. And yes, the treaties suck. However, remember that treaties can go just so far when it comes to the regulations involved in how they're interpreted in the woven web. So just remember that. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The Two-Way Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.